Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for November 3rd, 2016, and also with WBAI's pre-election coverage. Today in Standing Rock, North Dakota, hundreds of clergy of various faiths joined protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline in southern North Dakota. They were singing hymns, marching, and burning a copy of a 600-year-old document. We're joined now by Earth Mom, who is in North Dakota, to tell us about what happened today.
The Episcopal priest at Standing Rock, Father John Floberg, made a call out to clergy of all faiths over the country to come and pray at Standing Rock. 524 clergy came, and they led a prayer circle at camp repudiating the doctrine of discovery, and they burned a copy of it. And interestingly enough, 524 clergy came, and it's been 524 years since Columbus. And they wanted to make it clear that they no longer abide in this inhumane and unjust doctrine, this law that came from the Roman Catholic Church.
And this document that was burned today, this is a document from the 1400s. It sanctioned the taking of the land from indigenous people, and that was the document. So where are the clergy now? This is about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Where are they now?
Now they are on their way up to Governor Dalrymple's office to give him a letter, and they're asking him to stop the pipeline, and they are asking him to treat all Lakota and all Native people with due respect.
And these clergy are from where? They're from all over, aren't they?
They are from all over, and they are from all faiths and all denominations. And, you know, Chief Orville Looking Horse, 21 years ago, started World Peace and Prayer Day, and the line for that is all nations, all faiths, one prayer, and it's all coming together now.
So this is an attempt at reconciliation.
Well, the water protectors, you know, went up and they prayed with them, and we have a sacred fire, and it's in the circle, and it's kind of the whole meeting place of the camp, and many people were there with them. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, 524 years later after Columbus, that the church is starting to recognize, or probably more than starting, but understanding the dastardly deeds that they've done. You know, between the boarding schools, taking children away, washing children's mouths out with soap for speaking their language, and much more than that. I mean, horrible things have been done. You know, children have been compromised in so many ways, where there was even a boarding school with a graveyard. So there were deaths of these sweet, innocent children. And, you know, what we've done to Native people, and the church in particular, working with the state, you know, changing the Indian and, you know, making them white, or, you know, crazy stuff.
WBAI's Earth Mom in North Dakota. The interfaith event today was organized to draw attention to concerns of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation and to push elected officials to call for a halt to construction of the pipeline. The $3.8 billion pipeline would carry North Dakota oil through South Dakota and Iowa to a shipping point in Illinois. The tribe believes the pipeline will skirt its reservation and threaten its drinking water and cultural sites. Continuing with local news, 49-year-old Ariel Galarza, an emotionally distraught Bronx man brandishing a glass bottle, died after he was subdued by an NYPD sergeant with a stun gun. The confrontation happened at a home in the Bronx at about 5:30 p.m. last night. This while officers were responding to a neighbor's call saying the man was menacing her and acting violently. Three officers confronted Galarza. Police say he threatened them with the bottle. A sergeant discharged his stun gun. Police said the man kept struggling with the officers and the sergeant used his stun gun a second time. Police say that while in custody, the man went into cardiac arrest. CPR was administered. He was then taken to a hospital where he died. The incident is being investigated by the Force Investigation Division pending determination of the cause of death, according to police. Just last month, 66-year-old Deborah Danner was shot and killed wielding a baseball bat. The mayor and police commissioner called Danner's death unacceptable and tragic and called out the department's failure to use another means than deadly force. But here you have a man dead once again at the hands of police who used a stun gun. Communities United for Police police reform say there's clearly a long-standing problem with the police department handling these incidents, and tasers are not a safe weapon of force. It points out that this is at least the third New Yorker to be killed by taser in the last year and a half, which raises grave concerns about the NYPD and other city agencies disseminating these weapons more widely to officers. Communities United for Police Reform is asking the Attorney General's Special Prosecutor to do a full investigation into this killing and not defer to the Bronx District Attorney. In other local news, residents in public housing and communities of color are upset with NYPD patrols in their buildings. They feel like they are under siege, according to Carmen Dixon with the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund.
They're simply under occupation in their own homes. It's as simple as that. And the police in public housing actually are also enforcing house rules. So something as simple as bouncing a basketball in public housing then becomes an issue for not only the residents, but also the residents' guests.
Dixon brings up Akai Gurley, the young man who died in the Pink Houses in Brooklyn 2 years ago when rookie NYPD officer Peter Liang killed Gurley on vertical patrol with his gun drawn in the public housing complex. Liang was sentenced to 5 years probation and 800 hours of community service. Dixon says the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund has been working with the Gurley family. The anniversary of his death is coming up at the end of November.
We want to see change. We want to see police not occupying people's homes and residents and terrorizing people.
The opportunity for public housing and city residents to participate in court-ordered NYPD reform is being presented at Our Community, Our Solutions forums throughout the city. The aim is to create enduring reforms to stop, stop and frisk, and other NYPD abuses. The forums will take place throughout the city. The first one is this evening in Jackson Heights, Queens, presented by DRUM, Dacey's Rising Up and Moving. For more information, go to Communities United for Police Reform. In other news, a federal judge has called for strengthening protections against discriminatory surveillance by the NYPD. Andrea Sears reports.
The ruling comes in a lawsuit challenging the NYPD's warrantless surveillance of the Muslim community. Based on a report by the city's inspector general, the ruling rejects a proposed settlement saying it wouldn't protect law-abiding Muslims' constitutional rights. Albert Kahn with the New York chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations supports the ruling. He calls it gratifying to be moving beyond the impulse to sacrifice civil liberties in the name of security.
Now, even the federal judiciary is making it clear that we've gone too far in surveying too many for no reason, and that these practices really need to end.
The ruling calls for strengthening provisions of the 1985 Hanshu Consent Decree, which sets limits on NYPD surveillance of political and religious groups. According to Kahn, the ruling says the NYPD's Intelligence Bureau had a systemic inclination to disregard surveillance guidelines.
The judge found probable cause that the NYPD had exceeded the time limits and restrictions placed on surveillance by the existing consent decree.
One recommendation of Judge Charles Haight, who issued the ruling, is expanding the power and autonomy of the civilian member of the panel that oversees NYPD surveillance. While the ruling only affects surveillance by New York City police, Kahn says it reinforces evidence of rights being violated across the country.
That there are significant abuses by intelligence agencies that are surveilling the Muslim community, whether they be the NYPD, federal agencies, or other groups.
Judge Haight indicated that if the parties agree to his recommendations, the court would be inclined to approve the settlement. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
In other local news, protests at City College were held today over free speech on campus. We caught up with Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
What's happening right now is that the Revolution Club is holding a rally in front of the NAC building on CCNY's campus, and the reason for this rally is to demand that the university stop arresting revolutionaries who come up on campus and lift the barring orders on two of the revolutionaries who they have arrested several times. And right now, one of the members of the Revolution Club is talking to students about the importance of revolution, revolutionary ideas, and a scientific assessment of why humanity faces the horrors that it does, why police brutalize and murder people again and again, why this system steps on the rights of indigenous people from Standing Rock today all the way through its history to the original genocide, why tens of millions of people are being driven from their homeland by the imperialist wars that the U.S. brings down, and the fact that we could end all of this through revolution. And she's also issuing a call to students and faculty to join us in taking the demand to lift the order, the barring orders on the revolutionaries and to stop arresting revolutionaries, to the newly appointed president here at City College.
Now, our listeners, our WBAI listeners, are familiar with Noche Diaz, with the Revolution Club. Can you tell us what happened to him in Chicago?
Well, what happened with him in Chicago is that he was arrested on the campus of the University of Chicago, talking to students about the horrors of this world and the need for revolution to end it. He was told to leave the cafeteria he made this announcement in, and as he was leaving at the door, the campus police set upon him and arrested him, and then they also banned him from campus.
What's your statement, Noche?
I want everybody to take a good look at what is happening right here in the University of Chicago. They talk about allowing freedom of speech, but if you actually do it, they'll take you down. We are the mighty, mighty Rev Cons. We will not be intimidated by pigs. We will not be intimidated by the people who protect war criminals. They invited John Kerry, who's a war criminal, but they're going to arrest me for calling out crimes against you.
It's assaulted first. We have it on film.
This past Tuesday, the Revolution Club in Chicago held a rally on the campus of the University of Chicago, where Noche, other revolutionaries, family members of people murdered by police, and others gathered, and 60 to 70 students came out. And they were not attacked. Noche wasn't arrested for going back on the campus. And that's a fight that we're continuing here as well as the fight here. There are a couple dozen students out at this rally. Nicholas Hayward, the father of Nicholas Hayward Jr., who was murdered by police in Brooklyn 22 years ago, just spoke. And right now they're reading letters from people who are calling for the banning order to be lifted on the revolutionaries here at the City College of New York.
And finally, we are approaching, we are very close to this election. We're days away. What can you say to people who are going out to vote? What's your advice?
Well, here's my advice. We need to overthrow, not vote for this system. What we have is a choice between an open fascist in Donald Trump and a proven war criminal in Hillary Clinton. Neither of them have anything good in store for the masses of oppressed people here in this country and around or around the world. And I'm not going to vote. I urge others not to vote. And then I add one other thing. Donald Trump's fascists are talking about intimidating black people and Latino people out of voting. And although I don't think people should vote, I'm not going to stand aside and let that happen. I'm going to be defending the right to vote. We've sent people into Cleveland and Phoenix. We're looking at other places where this may happen. And I've issued an article that's on the website revcom.us that speaks to why I'm not going to vote, why I urge others to vote, but also why I will defend the right of black people, Latinos, and other oppressed people to vote, and why that's important and why there's not a logical contradiction in that logic.
And what about third party candidates?
Well, look, people are going to do what they're going to do. What we really need to do is organize right now for an actual revolution to get rid of this system. That's what's needed, not choosing between the poisons that the system puts up there for us to take. And look, we're not actually doing anything about the horrors by voting third party or whatever. we need to organize for an actual revolution. We need to overthrow this system at the soonest possible moment.
Carl Dix with the Revolutionary Communist Party. You can read more by going to revcom.us. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. And while Carl Dix may not be voting third party, there are many New Yorkers who are voting strategically, who may be voting the Green Stein-Baraka ticket. Last night, Jill Stein appeared live at WBAI's Katie Halper show with co-host Gabe Pacheco. Stein says she is looking to the future.
Well, you know, one thing, let me say, that we hope to do just straight out of the gate as we begin the next cycle, you know, number one is to continue working with the social movements that really are the engine of change, the movement for climate justice, for indigenous rights, for workers' rights, and for peace, for immigrant rights. We continue to work with these campaigns and to work more closely with them. But also, I think it's really critical, as we move into the next cycle, to end for once and for all the stranglehold of fear on our votes. It's time, coming out of this election where so many people are really torn by this abusive political system, we need to start offering people a way forward with ranked choice voting. That needs to be the civil disobedience campaign for the next 4 years.
Can you explain ranked choice voting for a listener?
So real simple. What ranked choice voting is, it lets you rank your choices. So instead of just, you know, casting your dice and hoping that your vote is going to do what you hope it will, instead, you are guaranteed, if your first choice loses, your vote is automatically reassigned to your second choice. So there is no possibility of, quote, throwing your vote away or inadvertently helping a candidate that you don't support. It really ensures that our votes will be used democratically, small d, to actually bring our values into our votes. Because if we're only voting our fears, then democracy has no moral compass. It doesn't have our values. It doesn't have our vision. But that's what it desperately needs if we are going to get out of here alive. So that's what we got to do.
Now, what's your favorite of the smears? I feel like there are three general smears. So if I had like trivia music, I would put that on right now. But there's the you're a Putin stooge. Mm-hmm. There's the you're doing this to get rich, and then there's the you are an anti-vaxxer. So of the three of those, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to them, but also tell us which one you find the most exciting.
I find it really exciting when people tell me that I'm anti-science after more years of science education than I think many of the people in this room are of age. You know, I had 4 years of college, then I had 4 years of medical school, and then I had 3 years of residency. So I've had quite a bit of science, and I really get quite a kick out of people telling me that I'm anti-science, that I'm anti-vax, and that I'm anti-Wi-Fi. And, you know, I believe that science should be allowed to actually ask real questions without censorship and interference from corporate America that may not like the questions that are being asked. So I believe that the FDA should not be run by pharmaceutical companies, and it should not be run by Monsanto and the GMO companies. I think we have a crisis of trust in all of our institutions. We know this. There's something like a, what is it, like a 10% trust rate in our political institutions now, 10%, slightly
that
more than
high.
That. Yeah, probably it is high. I think it's like on a level of cockroaches that people have as much support for Congress. So, you know, it's like, well, duh, let's get the big money out of this and return our political institutions, our political parties, our regulatory boards, not just the FDA, but the EPA and the CDC and all of them, to actually regulating on behalf of people, not on behalf of profit and the lobbyists and the campaign contributions that are basically doing this pay-to-play thing inside of our regulatory institutions. I say make that comparison any day on who is funding, you know, our two campaigns. You know, I'm being funded by anonymous people, basically, on the internet, making small donations. We know where Hillary's money is coming from. It's from the big banks. It's from the war profiteers. It's from the fossil fuel companies. And she is delivering to pay back the hands that are feeding her. So, you know, whatever you look at our policies on workers' rights. You know, look at our policies on minimum wage. You know, I'm calling for a living wage, minimum of $15 an hour. Hillary waffles a little bit and mostly lands around $12 an hour, which is still a poverty wage. We deserve living wages. She will not disavow fracking. She wants to expand the wars. She does not have a solution for mass incarceration, nor for the incredible crisis of racism in our communities. We are calling for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as well as for reparations to get to the bottom of this ongoing crisis of racism.
Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein at WBAI's Brooklyn location on the Katie Halper Show with co-host Gabe Pacheco last night. And you're listening to election coverage here on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. President Barack Obama campaigned for Hillary Rodham Clinton today in the battleground state of Florida, which carries 29 electoral votes. He says people need to come out and vote to stop Donald Trump.
If you disrespected women before you were in office, you will disrespect women as president. If you accept the support of Klan sympathizers before you are president, you will accept their support after you're president. If you disrespect the Constitution before you're president, and threaten to shut down the press when it says something you don't like, or threaten to throw your opponent in jail in a live presidential debate without any regard for due process. If you discriminate against people of different faiths before you are president, then that is what you will do in office, except you will have more power to carry out the twisted notions that you had before you were in office.
Obama continued saying this election isn't a television program. It's not Survivor or The Bachelorette. He says this counts and has to do with what's happening in your family, in your community, to soldiers and veterans, to the safety of our kids. Pitching to the crowd, Obama said, while Trump is unqualified, in Hillary Rodham Clinton, we have perhaps the most qualified person to run as president. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's wife, Melania, campaigned for him in a Philadelphia suburb.
Do we want a president who is beholden to no one but you, the American people? Yes. Do we want a president who is a fighter for us and will never give up? Yes. Then we want Donald Trump to be our president.
There are 20 electoral votes in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. This was Melania Trump's first solo campaign speech meant to soften Trump's image. In other campaign news, with FBI Director James Comey signaling renewed interest in Clinton's email server, he's been attacked by Democrats saying he is interfering with the election, and he's been called out for not maintaining parity regarding Donald Trump. And it's been revealed that the FBI is in the midst of an internal feud over its investigations into the Clinton Foundation and Clinton's emails, With only 5 days until the election, the FBI is also said to have launched an internal investigation related to a release of documents about Bill Clinton and Fred Trump. They were released on an FBI automated Twitter account, an account that had been dormant for over a year. Rebecca Miles has more.
The FBI's internal investigation into its own Twitter account began after a series of documents were released on FBI Records Vault on Sunday. Documents leaked include a 129-page report on Bill Clinton's financier friend, Mark Rich, who the former president pardoned just before he left office, despite Rich's corrupt past. Most of the pardon inquiry was redacted. Before Rich was pardoned, he was facing corruption charges for violating U.S. government sanctions against Iran when he was involved in selling oil for the Iranians. After the pardon, billionaire Rich skipped the country. Rich has since died. The other release was documents about Donald Trump's father, Fred, who was described by FBI agents as a philanthropist as well as a real estate developer. Another tweet linked to previously released internal investigative notes from the FBI's probe of Clinton's private email server. The document disclosures happened after the FBI director, James Comey, released a letter to Congress last week confirming that emails found on a computer owned by Clinton aide and her husband, Anthony Weiner, could be linked to the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server. In a related story, it turns out the FBI was allegedly in a feud internally after it began an investigation into the Clinton Foundation. The investigation was prompted by allegations made by former Bush speechwriter Peter Schweitzer in his book Clinton Cash, the untold story of how and why foreign governments and businesses helped make Bill and Hillary rich. And centered on whether the agency should conduct a full investigation into whether the Clinton Foundation contributors received favorable treatment from the State Department when Hillary was Secretary of State. The book took a beating not only from its publisher, but from Amazon, who had to admit publicly that sections of the book had to be rewritten because of false information. Turns out the FBI had secret recordings from interviews with informants in an unrelated public corruption case where suspects talked about alleged deals the Clintons made. The FBI and Justice Department decided in December 2015 not to pursue the investigation as the suspects were weak and they weren't people inside the Clinton Foundation. However, FBI agents in New York wouldn't drop the case until the Justice Department issued a directive to officers involved in telling them to stand down in February 2016 and had to again as late as August this year to call the New York office to tell the deputy director that agents there didn't seem to be obeying their instructions. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
And finally, economics professor Richard Wolff shares this commentary on the 2016 election.
We have a presidential race that is peculiar. Some think it's the most peculiar in history, or at least in living memory. We have four candidates, but a country that seems to have decided long before the election that two of them don't deserve to be exposed to the public, that don't deserve to have a chance to make their case to the media and thereby to the mass of people. So two of the four are excluded. It's extraordinary. And in a country that claims to be democratic, it's doubly extraordinary. So we're left with the two quote-unquote major candidates, Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton. Well, what can you say? This is a question of economics for me because my program on WBAI is economic update each week. So that's how I'm going to look at it. For me, it's a question, are the basic economic issues of our time being addressed in this election? And if so, what's the difference between the two major candidates, one of whom is going to win, and the other one? So let me do that. For me, here are the basic questions. The United States has, for the last 40 years, become a more and more unequal society. A tiny percentage of people at the top controls more and more wealth. And the mass of people are having a harder and harder time. In some cases, putting enough food on the table. In other cases, paying for the college education that their children are told is the only way to have a decent work situation and earn a decent living. That inequality is one of the key economic problems. And because it's been going on for so long, and because it's rooted so deeply in the capitalist system we have, it would take a massive, major program to be offered by a candidate as to what he or she will do once elected, if there's any hope of dealing with it. So let me begin by analyzing with you briefly whether the two candidates have offered such programs and what's the difference between them. My answer is quick and simple. Neither of the major candidates has offered anything like a major program to deal with this problem. Mr. Trump, by and large, ignores it, makes passing reference to this or that, but in no way confronts this issue in a serious programmatic way. Mrs. Clinton expresses more sympathy for people who are on the short end of that inequality stick. She says she's concerned, but when you look at the concrete proposals she makes, they are at the margins of the situation. They might make it a little less extreme than it now is, but they don't begin to address a 40-year redistribution of wealth and income in this country from the mass of people to the richest at the top. When I turn to the next biggest problem, it's instability. We're living through the second collapse of capitalism in 75 years. We have a recovery that only benefits the top 10%. Everybody else is in trouble. What are you going to do about that instability? From the two candidates, nothing. Nothing. It's as if it's a non-problem. And so finally, the injustice of an economic system that condemns the mass of people to recurring every 4 to 7 year economic downturns and to a growing, deepening gap between rich and poor. On those two fundamental questions, we get little or almost nothing. For me, the economic message of this presidential race is that presidential politics in America are weapons of mass distraction. They don't add to, they detract from any hope that the election will make a big difference.
Richard Wolff is professor of economics, University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's host of Economic Update. It airs on WBAI in New York on Friday at 9 a.m. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, November 3rd, 2016. The news was produced with Katie Halper, Rebecca Miles, Brian Isom, Max Schmid, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.